Welcome to the 141st episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 50 years to the day since the slowest day of Test cricket ever played in England. Pakistan and England made 159 in 108 overs at Headingley. Wisden called it poor fare for the Saturday crowd. We call it proper Test cricket.
I don't think we've got much in the way of proper Test cricket in today's Reverse Swept Radio, but we are going to be talking about Andy's return to form as a bowler. If you ever want poor fare for a Saturday crowd, that's probably it. We are going to be looking at Samuel Beckett, the Irish writer, and his relationship with cricket, and we're going to be reviewing Sweet Summers, the classic cricket writing of J.M. Kilburn. Just before I start, as ever, please do hop over onto iTunes, leave us a review, tweet us at Reverse Swept, and wave to us as you pass us in the street. We welcome any form of contact. Andy, you've been out on the pitch. How's it been going?
I have. In and amongst the rain of what has so far been a slightly grey British summer. And I've been bowling again, which is quite a rare activity for me. My bowling has long been a source of shame. At 6'3", I've had to get used to letting down new teammates who assume that I must bowl a bit of pace.
And instead you're keeping wicket, yeah.
Indeed. And I've never got above military medium. There's probably a whole feature to do on this about why, you know, there are some very short people who can bowl pace wonderfully and some tall people like me who everyone expects to be able to bowl pace, and the limbs never quite go in the way they need to. I haven't been a regular bowler for years. I bowled a fair bit as a teenager, bowled on and off as an adult, but haven't done so for years. So I was very excited to get the chance to turn my arm over a couple of weekends ago. These days, like so many batsmen who don't really bowl, I attempt off spin. Much to my genuine astonishment, my second ball turned and hit middle stump. And I had so little faith in my bowling that I didn't celebrate. I looked kind of perplexed at the wicketkeeper, assuming that he must have knocked the bails off. And it was just a lot of fun. If you haven't bowled for a while, in the same way, I guess, if you're a bowler who very rarely bats, it's like a whole dimension of the game that's slightly hidden to you. So it was very exciting to rediscover that.
Do you also have that feeling that I often have, which is, because I'm not much of a bowler either, but, you know, after a few games kind of, you know, fielding in the covers, I sort of think to myself, do you know what, maybe I would be great at bowling. Maybe if I did, you know, maybe I just haven't quite, you know, been given the chance to flourish, and if I took the ball now, something great would happen. And that is a constant delusion in the back of my head, like the facts, you know, the other delusion that I will one day open the batting for England.
The thing that supports this delusion, and I think I've confessed to this before on the podcast, is I have to say I find fielding duller than I used to. And I don't know if this is just the advance of years or... Yeah, I think I used to merrily get through overs in the field. And now it can be a little bit more of a slog, particularly if the team are up against it. And bowling is obviously rather wonderful for breaking it up. I think what I did find, having not done it for a while, is rocking up with zero expectations and sort of a smile on my face just to see what will happen. I think I used to put a lot more pressure on myself when I bowled. So I think, like many things in life, turning up with a smile and hoping for the best.
I think it's also the expectation from the team as well as from yourself, because if you are that occasional bowler, if you end up, you know, bowling an over and getting smacked all over the park, then it's kind of on the captain for having been stupid enough to put you on. And it's kind of, well, of course, Andy could never bowl. So why on earth did you give him a chance? So it's only uphill from there for you. So in the sense that, you know, when you did bowl that beautiful off break second ball clip, you know, pitch outside off and clip the top of middle or whatever it was, you're only kind of, you know, you're only going to benefit from that.
Well, obviously now I will be going away and working on my variations. So club cricketers of Southeast England, beware. Now, away from high quality spin bowling, you've been looking at what's been an interesting couple of weeks for the England team.
It has. So it's locked down here in Sydney. It's the middle of winter and I've been kind of, you know, escaping to an English summer insofar as I can. It's been an interesting couple of weeks for England. First off, glad to see Joe Root coming out and in a kind of bout of honesty that is quite uncharacteristic, I think, for modern modern sports, just being totally honest about the fact that the rotation policy just wasn't working, that they were gonna shelve that. So clearly the demands of international schedules are huge on any player that's playing ODIs, T20s and Test cricket, and that needs to be managed. But it was also clear that it wasn't working from both a kind of psychological and a sort of physical form perspective to be sort of effectively dropping players every test and going, yeah, you might have scored a century, but sorry, you're not going to play the next test match. So anyway, that was interesting to see Root doing that. But what was even more interesting was the kind of twist of fate that came after that. Having said no rotation, the fact that they were then forced to rotate effectively the entire squad, the entire one-day squad, because of the COVID outbreak that happened in the team, and fun to see the opportunity that gave to several players. So of that England side that played against Pakistan, that beat Pakistan, there were 135 ODI caps between them. Ben Stokes had 98 of them, which just shows the kind of the shallowness of experience elsewhere. Interesting that people like Saqib Mahmood and Zach Crawley and David Milan had, you know, all took the opportunity to make cases for their regular inclusion in the side as well.
I think the churn in the side created a level of interest in what otherwise would have been seen as a slightly humdrum ODI, perhaps. I mean, I found myself diligently remembering to stick it on the radio the other afternoon out of just sheer curiosity. You know, how is this kind of side of motley crew of, you know, in some cases, you know, pretty serious experienced players, if not what ODI experienced, and also a couple of county guys who have kind of, in some cases, maybe been pushing for inclusion, but in other cases, maybe very surprised to be there.
Well, exactly. And so, you know, John Simpson was someone who was really interesting in that regard. So he was someone who'd, you know, I think he's 32 now. He'd played under 19 cricket for England. But after that, you know, effectively he was having a kind of, you know, successful county career, but never really troubling the England selectors. And I was amused to see that he's from Bury. And in the Bury local newspaper, there was a headline that said, you know, Bury keeper batsman in shock call up to the England team. And you kind of think, you want your local paper to be saying great news, well deserved, you know, all of that, because shock call up is kind of, you know, it's a little bit on the nose possibly. But I just thought a wonderful story for someone who realistically would never have played cricket for England otherwise. You look at some of the other players, you know, nice opportunity for them to play, and they're potentially going to get into the, you know, the regular squad, but for him, no chance of getting into the squad in the future. I wonder what it's like for him to know that the only reason he's been able to play, I mean, an England cap is an England cap. I'd take an England cap if someone offered me one for whatever reason. I'd make my debut. But you have to know that you're kind of a beneficiary of a particularly bizarre set of circumstances that have played out.
But of course, they won spectacularly the other day, this what some people have referred to as an England B team. We're recording prior to the second ODI, so we'll see how that goes against Pakistan. So this team have so far held their own, bizarre or not. Ever tried, ever failed. No matter. Try again, fail again, fail better. There speaks a man who knows and loves his cricket, the writer Samuel Beckett. And Toby, in today's From the Archives, will be looking at his relationship with the sport.
Fail better, that really could be the kind of motto for my own cricketing career. Look, it's unusual that a literary festival should heavily feature sport, but at the inaugural, and wait for this title, Happy Days Enniskillen International Beckett Festival in 2012. I was looking it up, actually. It looks like a great week. We should all head along.
Sign up.
But at this festival, started in 2012, there were several sporting events, including some races and a cricket match. And that cricket match was between a team representing Samuel Beckett against a team representing Harold Pinter. I have absolutely no idea who won, but the fact of this game's existence within the frame of a festival about Beckett shows the Irish author's obsession with the game of cricket. So it all started for Beckett when he was at school. He was a very fine sportsman. He played for his first 11 teams for both football and cricket, and the kind of, you know, oft quoted facts about him is that he's the only Nobel winner ever to appear in Wisden as a first-class player.
You also have to feel that that is a record that he can have a fair degree of confidence that that one he will never go. That feels increasingly hard with passing years and the passing in growing professionalism of the sport that anyone will ever take that off him.
It does. People kind of specialise earlier nowadays than they possibly did in the past.
We await Ben Stokes' Nobel Prize.
Indeed, and we can only speculate in which field he will get it. But back to Beckett, he as well as playing cricket, he also played golf and tennis, and he won school medals for swimming and boxing, and actually ended up being a lifelong fan of boxing as well. So he was a left-handed, gritty, self-described gritty opening batsman, and he was a left-arm medium-pace bowler. And the reason why he got into Wisden was that he played two first-class games when he was at university. So he was at Dublin University, and he played first-class games against Northants in 1925 and 1926. Now, he didn't necessarily cover himself in glory in those games. He scored 35 runs across four innings with a high score of 18. And with his bowling, he didn't necessarily trouble the batsman. He ended up with figures of none for 64 off 23 overs. So, you know, relatively tidy. And look, in many ways, this is the end of the story of Beckett and cricket. Because at the age of 22 in 1937, he moved to France, and opportunities to play cricket on the continent at that time were pretty few and far between. But he did remain fascinated by the game throughout his life. And there are some wonderful anecdotes. In 1961, he wrote in a letter about being in the long room at Lord's and seeing the great England batsman Frank Woolley escorting the, you know, great England all-rounder Wilfred Rhodes, who was that by then completely blind, to his seat, which is actually a really kind of powerful image in the way these giants of two different generations of English cricket together being witnessed by Beckett. And I'm sure that Beckett kind of appreciated the kind of hugeness of that moment in many ways. He also very much kept up with cricket that was happening at the time. Beckett's biographer James Nolson recounts talking to him about the achievements of Ian Botham soon after the 1981 Ashes, and specifically the Headingley Test. And apparently Beckett was one of those English people who would spend their time in France, you know, trying to find every newspaper that would give him the latest county scorecard so he could keep up with the game at any given point.
It's fascinating, this link between the expat and the home country and cricket consistently playing a role. Someone who maybe will one day do one from the archives is Kim Philby, who was famously sort of sitting in Moscow going through old county scores. And it's interesting for how many who end up either voluntarily or forced away from England, cricket remains that sort of tie, and as you say, that scorecard, that story of a Botham heroic innings is what keeps them connected.
Well, and you know, that is the interesting thing about that, is that Beckett, you know, famously when asked whether he was, you know, in French, asked, are you English? He said, absolutely not, I'm Irish. And it's interesting that he maintained this kind of connection with, you know, England and this kind of English side of him, despite the fact that he was fiercely and kind of avowedly Irish. So he's one of, you know, through history, there have been a number of literary types. We've talked before about Arthur Conan Doyle and his relationship with cricket, the amazing team that he founded with everyone from A.A. Milne and, you know, all sorts under the sun in that team. Harold Pinter, director Sam Mendes, the director of American Beauty, apparently brilliant school cricketer as well. So, you know, which makes one wonder, is there something kind of particularly connected about cricket and literature? Well, in Beckett's case, we all know, well, his most famous work is Waiting for Godot. And I was reading recently a theory that Waiting for Godot is a fact play all about cricket. And Arunabhnath Sengupta argues that the concept of Waiting for Godot is, how do you keep an audience glued to their seats while nothing happens for several days? And he says, well, surely this is a kind of perfect description of what cricket is. The play happens in two acts, like two innings perhaps. The characters all appear in pairs, like batsmen, bowlers and umpires. And look, I mean, to be honest, this theory kind of immediately reminded me of the kind of stuff I would come up with as an English literature undergrad in order to try and desperately connect two ideas.
Literary journals kind of need to be filled with something.
They absolutely do. There's another theory which is kind of a bit broader, which is that, you know, Beckett's obsession with sport more generally plays out in the way that he developed theatre. So he was renowned for creating a theatre that was physically taxing. So Not I, the famous kind of monologue that he developed, you had to read it as quickly as possible, and the actors describe having to warm up in certain ways, like physically warm up to do their acts. Billy Whitelaw, who worked with Beckett on it and read it in 13 minutes in 1973, apparently the current record is about 9 minutes 56 seconds or something like that, described the experience as being like an athlete crashing through barriers. Look, I think the kind of baseline of this is that Beckett was a good schoolboy cricketer. He clearly loved the game. I don't think we necessarily therefore need to read something as the rest of his life and career and his literary output on the back of that. And it's interesting that unlike someone like Pinter, Beckett never, in all of his many, many diaries, you know, and his many, many published works, never wrote about cricket.
There's something very curious about that. I mean, I wonder to what extent, you know, people have clear delineations about, well, this is my passion, not my work, and whether he separated it in this that way, or whether it was still a sort of snobbery. I mean, we've talked before around sports writing, I think, and cricket writing, maybe particularly amongst sports writing, has increasingly been viewed as a very legitimate and respected form of writing. But I think there are plenty of people who will always look down on sports writing as, you know, inferior to a play. Or I mean, I may be casting completely unfair aspersions on the way Beckett would have viewed it, but it's very interesting that someone with that passion wouldn't have put pen to paper on it.
I think you're right that he probably saw them as being separate worlds. And it's interesting because in Beckett's writing, he does, you know, he's not sort of highfalutin. He does talk about subjects that are of the everyday. But perhaps there was a sense to which he thought that, you know, cricket was a bit of part of a separate world here. I think, though, that there's something about the kind of sense of spectacle in the game, you know, the fact that he was so attracted to what happened at Headingley in 1981, and also the way that cricket plays out, the kind of pacing of a cricket match, which I think I think it's not a stretch to say probably informed the way that he wrote and his approach to writing as well. The review, and for the 141st episode of Reverse Swept Radio, we have been reading Sweet Summers, the classic cricket writing of J.M. Kilburn, edited by Duncan Hamilton. It was published in 2011. Jim Kilburn was the cricket correspondent of the Yorkshire Post from 1934 to 1976. Now, that is an impressive stint. Famed for his high expectations of how the game should be played, for refusing to write about off-field events, and for always having his copy ready the very moment after the final ball was bowled. So this particular collection brings together a series of his articles from throughout his career. There are player portraits, there are descriptions of grounds around England, and there are some match reports as well. Andy, what is most distinctive to you about Kilburn's writing?
So it's very poetic, and this slightly surprised me because I'd read something contrasting him with Cardus and saying, well, actually, Cardus is very poetic and Kilburn is much more sort of workaday. We have this of Tom Graveney. He has been of the orchard rather than the forest, blossoms susceptible to frost but breathtaking in the sunshine. Now, clearly, that is, you can take it or leave
it's
it.
Creamy stuff. It's creamy stuff.
Quite. Your love of flowery prose will affect how you respond to that. I must admit, I'm quite indulgent, and I quite enjoyed it. We have Emmett Robinson, who is a real favourite. He was a favourite of Cardus as well, wasn't he? His run up, prefaced by a little kickoff as though he were starting a motorcycle. We have more natural metaphors. Statham like an inexorable flood tide. Truman like a tempest.
It's poetic. But it's also quite kind of clear in a way. That description of Emmett Robinson's run-up and the idea of the starting like the kickoff of a motorcycle, you know straight away what he's talking about there. And it's interesting that idea of the distinction from Cardus, because with Cardus, I think there's this idea of here was the person who, you know, he was also a classical music critic at the same time, and then with Kilburn, he was the Yorkshireman who and I think that kind of idea of what Yorkshireman is, calling a spade, kind of, you know, affects our broad sense of what he is. I mean, he is very proud all the time of being kind of an independent. He says, "What I thought praiseworthy, I praised. Mm. What I thought inadequate, I condemned." And so maybe that's part of the kind of Cardus versus Kilburn thing as well.
He does something which I don't, to my knowledge, think Cardus ever does, although, you know, and it, in some ways maybe we're doing too much to set them up as contrasting pairs, but, you know, they were great writing figures of the time, where he acknowledges that sometimes he might be overdoing it. He writes an essay about Wally Hammond's walk to the crease, and then later sort of takes the mick out of himself, talking about, "Heavens above, I can hear the realist protest. What a song and a dance to make about a batsman simply walking to the wicket." So he has enough self-awareness to know that getting this carried away about cricket can be seen as absurd, but he's going to stick to it. He is a reporter, though, as well. And I think this is maybe one of the other things that, for a writer who in some ways seems quite old-fashioned, is actually... can be strikingly modern. He takes seriously, how exactly does that bowler bowl? How do they turn it? How do they vary pace? And it reminds me, some of those passages, of a lot of the kind of stuff you get now on Crick Info or Crick Viz or stuff, where you've got writers really seriously trying to break down technique.
I think there is a sort of tension within his writing, which comes through from what you were saying, between this idea of the kind of, you know, the romantic and the realistic, you know, almost. He writes a lot about the fact that there's an essay in which he talks about the fact that the setting for a cricket match is completely irrelevant. That actually, you know, a beautifully played shot is the same whether it's beautifully played in a backyard or a back lane, or whether it's at Lord's, or whether it's at a beautiful county ground. That actually the kind of intrinsic beauty of a moment of cricket is contained within that moment of cricket. He goes so far at one point as to say cricket is, quotes, ethically independent of the scoreboard, and he actually kind of laments this increasing need for spectators to know what the score is. You know, he expects people to be able to turn up and just go, "I am appreciating this for the beauty of the moment, not for what is actually happening within the broader context."
You've reminded me that there's a running theme, particularly in some of the essays about players, where he's constantly making this point that, like, stats don't tell you everything. So, and he seems infuriated by the use of statistics to prove a player's worth, although he does then sometimes do it himself. Where do you rank him on the sort of curmudgeon spectrum, on the sort of things were better?
Well, that's a leading... That is about as leading a question as I think you could possibly... I think that's called leading the witness. Because there is a... It's really difficult to... you know, kind of judge, in inverted commas, the whether someone writing in an era well before our own is old-fashioned or not by the standards of the time. But certainly this kind of ongoing concern, which we hear reflected in talk about cricket at the moment, of whether cricket is going down the drain, and whether the, you know, you could apply so much of Kilburn's writing to writing about the 100 now and just change the topic of exactly, you know, Sunday cricket. He believed that Sunday cricket was this thing. It's kind of, yes, I get it, the people need to make more money, but it's going to destroy the, you know, destroy the attitude of the spectators towards the game. Say exactly the same thing is being said about the 100 now. He does occasionally quite amusingly say, "I'm not one of those people who believes that things that happened in the past are necessarily better than things that happen in the present." But almost every single example or kind of elaboration that he gives suggests to the contrary around that, I think.
I mean, some of this can give you great confidence because we are in 2021 and conversations, as you say, are alive and well about the decline of the county championship. And to hear Kilburn lamenting that the Yorkshire of the 60s were not appreciated as they were in the 30s, that even at that stage he thought the county championship was going, you're like, this championship is a bit more resilient than perhaps we give it credit for. I apologize, I think I always overquote, but it's fun. The taste for smoked salmon and well-grilled steak is not stimulated by a diet of candy floss and fish and chips. As you say, you could imagine a certain grumpy MCC member applying that to the 100 today.
Having said that, I think that one of the things that I most enjoy about this collection is getting to know certain players of the past through Kilburn's eyes. and he the kind of affection in which he holds players and his ability to be discursive and to, as you've described, you know, use metaphor and flowery language, actually I think does mean that you're able to get a sense of the players over and above simply, you know, their scoreboard achievements. It's that kind of question of what does a player mean to you when they walk to the wicket, to use your previous example of, you know, I think it's Wally Hammond's walk to the wicket that he talks about. And you actually think about how we define cricketers nowadays, often that is the thing. What is distinctive about Ben Stokes? It is actually, you know, the way that spectators interact with the idea of him and the way that he goes about things, more than it is necessarily the actual scores that he puts on the board. And so for that reason, I think I actually find it a really valuable collection, because you suddenly kind of connect with some of these players that otherwise for us would purely be on the page. In a way that's more genuine, I think.
But this, I think, is exactly where the two sides of his writing, the sort of poetic side and the reporting side, come together. Because to be able to talk about Hammond's walk to the wicket, you have to be a great reporter. You have to spot those details, and he clearly does that. I think the range of the collection is great fun as well, and proof of a fine writer, in that, as you say, you know, the essays about players are perhaps the most memorable. There's also wonderful passages about his views on various grounds. And there's a really memorable piece that sticks out, because it's almost not really a cricket piece at all, about the last days of cricket before the start of the Second World War.
Yes.
And very, very poignant, and this sense it of is, this yeah. thing matters, but does it still matter? And I think it says a lot of a writer who is comfortable across that whole range.
This is a collection of, you know, articles, individual articles brought together into a book. I think that probably it's done a disservice by trying to read it from cover to cover in one kind of in one go, in one stint. It's the kind of book that you want to keep on hand and dip into.
It's a dipper.
Dip out of over time, I think. It's definitely a dipper. But I think on that basis, it probably comes with our high recommendation. That is Sweet Summers, the classic cricket writing of J.M. Kilburn, edited by Duncan Hamilton. Regular listeners to the podcast will know Duncan Hamilton, another favourite of ours as well. And that was the 141st episode of Reverse Swept Radio. The next time we talk to you, it'll inevitably be Andy telling us about another of his off breaks, pitching outside, pitching on fourth stump, hitting top of middle. See you next time.